you are tuned into 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and you're listening to Final Draft. It is books, writing, and literary culture coming to you every week from however and wherever we can record. It is strange and difficult times that we're facing at the moment, and I want to be there to help bring you books that might be able to entertain, give you solace, give you entertainment and support. To begin, I just want to acknowledge 2SER Studios. We do record and broadcast from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and acknowledge the traditional owners. Now, today on the show, I want to offer you a couple of new books. I have two fantastic selections, but at this time, I know that so many of you are also getting creative in your social isolation. Like if you're stuck in your house and you're working from home and you're reading lots of books, some of you are starting up online book clubs. If you're doing any of these just amazing, incredible things to be creative with your books, drop us a line. We're at Final Draft 2SER. You can also drop a line to at 2SER on your social media. Let us know what you're doing. I'd love to give a shout out to some of the amazing bookish ideas, and also support your local authors, support your local bookshops. Many of them are still finding ways to deliver to you, to get you the read that you want. And it's really important that, you know, if you are going to read, why not go local? And on that note, I have two fantastic books for you today. Coming up on the show, Terence J. Quinn has had a long history in media and publishing, and he pours all of that into his series with his protagonist, John O'Bly, the second of which is Deadline, we're going to be discussing today, as John O'Bly is recruited to a London tabloid where he faces terror, treason, and all sorts of plotting. Later on in the show, Karina Kilmore, also a reporter, takes us into the land of the Melbourne docks in Where the Truth Lies to uncover a conspiracy down there. Two great books on the theme of media, and isn't it so important to kind of understand the media at the moment? I definitely get into that with both Terence and Karina. So stay tuned. I have fantastic books for you. Don't forget the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast if you want to take Final Draft with you wherever you go, in your pocket any time. We're not going very far actually at the moment, but it is there for you whenever you want. And it is all coming up after this short break.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3, and this is Final Draft. It's books, writing and literary culture every week. My name is Andrew Popel, and I am joined on the line by Terence J. Quinn. Now, Terry is based in Noosa after a long career in journalism that's taken him around the world, working as a reporter, editor and publisher. And Terry is currently working on a trilogy of novels set in the high-octane world of the newsroom. Today, he is joining me from his home in Noosa to discuss the second in the series, centred on his intrepid journo, John O'Bly. Welcome, Terry. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Andrew, for having me on your show.
Now, at the beginning of Deadline, John O'Bly, he survived the events of The Scoop, and he's looking for a peaceful life back in Sydney. That is, until he's headhunted by a Russian oligarch to head up the British tabloid UK Today as its editor. Uprooting his young family and peaceful existence, Jono heads to London and headlong into conspiracy, terror and treason. So I guess the place to begin, Terry, is a question that you actually pose to yourself in your bio on your webpage. Is there anything more thrilling than a newsroom? Can you evoke something of the newsrooms of your experience that have inspired your novels for me?
Well, I think somewhere in the book, Andrew, I talk about it being a jungle that, you know, it's like a jungle. It comes awake mainly after dark. During the day, newsrooms kind of are quietish places that people are working away on their stories or they're editing or designing, as the case may be. But the momentum of the day, you know, really ratchets up mid-afternoon to late evening, and you know, the noise and the I guess the excitement, even the smells start to sound like a big top. And you know, I liken it to you know, big beasts waking up and looking for prey.
Now, John is headhunted by a Russian oligarch, Boris Bolshakov, and he decides to move to London to take up this opportunity. It's the first of many unilateral decisions that he's going to make that have mixed consequences. And we see this in the editorials that he writes against terror acts that very much sort of explode the opening of the novel. These editorials result in death threats against himself, his family, and the newspaper. And what I wondered was, in this sense, this sort of recursive process, do media companies and editors have a... are they both reporting the news but also having a hand in creating it? Is that been your experience?
For sure. And particularly in the UK, both the tabloids and what used to be the broadsheets are both pretty proactive when it comes to the news, and that's from a positive and a negative perspective. Negative, obviously, because they're very aggressive. I describe it as jugular journalism. When you start the day and you identify the main stories and the characters that are involved in those stories, and basically you unleash the hounds to go after them, and find the facts and dig the stories. And the purpose, particularly of a tabloid newspaper, is to set the news agenda for the day. So you want to come out tomorrow morning with a front page story that everyone's going to have to scramble to cover, television, radio, online, you name it. And that sets the agenda for the day. So the dog eat dog world is a little muzzled these days, but it still exists. But on the plus side, I mean, the newspapers, again, tabloids in the main, have created huge social change for the better. They've had the laws change. I mean, in the UK, newspaper I edited at one time, you know, it was responsible for getting gun control after the Dunblane massacre. And the newspaper worked with the incoming Labour government, as it was then, Tony Blair, to create the climate to have guns taken off the streets. And there are many other examples where newspapers have been hugely proactive in changing both culture and the law for the better.
Now, you mentioned the tabloids and the broadsheets, and I feel like those are terms that are probably not as well understood today as they might have been even 10 years ago. So thank you for sort of unpacking that a little bit for us. But I want to think again about those headlines you were talking about. We've got, you know, the modern conception of clickbait, something that is designed to get you to just kind of keep going through. And it can be a little bit ethically dubious, or at least dubious in the usage of your time. Is there anything of that in Jono, do you think, or is it very much the headline needs to be created by a person with good grounding, good morals, good ethics behind them?
Well, I think, you know, it's a great question, because currently, as we're all aware, it's all changing. And whatever you thought of the old days of some of the, ethical decisions of newspapers in general, tabloids in particular, we're now faced with, the power and influence of newspapers beginning to dwindle and move into the digital space. But along with that goes the training and the regulation and the basic concept that we're trying to put a newspaper out that is as accurate as we can make it, and we're going to abide by the law, and we're going to push the limits, but we're going to largely abide by the law. Nowadays, it's you know, vloggers, bloggers, and floggers. You know, it's influencers and people who are writing stories that and columns that are basically spooking products and companies for money. So the old days where we were, you know, people, you, companies, institutions, governments were making informed decisions based on what they'd read in the press. Now that that's on its way out, how are people going to make those informed decisions in the future when, you know, you're reading material which is prepared by people who are getting paid by companies to produce it?
I want to continue then with this this role of the editor and your protagonist, Jono, because he very much comes into the role nervous, but wanting to shape it, wanting to do a good job. But I also found him to be less an inspiring creature at times. Throughout the novel, he's absent from his family. He ignores the danger to those around him and can be quite violent and reactive. This single-mindedness, though, it also helps him see through the story that we're going to keep in a spoiler-free bubble for readers to discover. I wondered, when you get to the top, when you are at the... You're guiding this high-stakes game, is goodness a luxury?
Look, it's an incredibly pressured position. I mean, on one hand, you've got a lot of power and a fair degree of influence. I mean, you know, people will pick up your call, you're the prime minister or you know, big business or whatever. But alongside that, you know, huge responsibility and pressure from cutthroat competition, the constant deadlines, the decision making, the political intrigue, and as I mentioned there, the legal constraints. So people, you know, it was certainly true in the UK. I think it's less true these days, that a lot of editors were, let's be honest, despots. You know, they had to be. They had to make decisions on the fly. One every 5 minutes, you could be sitting in the loo in the office and still be taking calls, people demanding decisions to be made. So I don't think you can afford to be, you know, reflective or, you know, you're largely working on adrenaline and instinct. And of course you're going to make some bad decisions along the way. But, you know, if you, and I think Jono, you know, is basically good at heart and he is trying to do the right thing. And, but of course he's flawed and he's going to do some terrible things along the way.
Yeah, you show some pretty cataclysmic consequences for the perhaps oversights, that he has made. I really don't want to spoil. I really don't want to spoil a very big part at the end of the book. But there's a certain thread that he had downplayed that. I feel like I can use the analogy blows up in his face.
We do call it an incendiary political thriller. Look, sure, but you know, the newspapers and newspaper editors are subject to threats all the time. I mean, I could tell you some things I won't, but, you know, that would make your hair curl. Unfortunately, mine can't curl because I don't have much of it left. And that's largely because of the pressures I was under at one time. Look, threats come almost daily. Some of them are legal, as in, you know, we're going to destroy your newspaper and all this type of thing. Others, I think there's one scene in the book which is largely true, and that's where the cardinal rings Jono and threatens him that he will instruct all the parish priests to tell their congregations the following Sunday to stop subscribing to the newspaper. Now, that actually happened to me. So, you know, a lot of the subplots that are intertwined with the two main plots are true. You know, they're based on stuff that happened with the names changed to protect the guilty. But so, look, the pressures are real, and they're not all just, you know, legal or you know, threats from advertisers to withdraw the business, etc. A lot of them come from gangsters. They come from politicians, and they're serious, and occasionally they threaten violence. So while inevitably in a novel, and let's be honest, I'm writing what I call gulp fiction. You know, I'm gonna push that. That concept. Mm. But as we both know, journalists around the world are still being killed probably on a daily basis.
Thank you so much, Terence. This has been such a great chat about the role of the newspaper. And I want to remind the listener that I'm speaking with Terence J. Quinn. And if you would like to really get deeper into this struggle to hold the powerful to account, Terence's latest book is Deadline, and we see editor John O'Bly take on some of those forces that we have just been discussing. Terry, look, this has been a real pleasure to chat, and thank you also for your insights coming from your years of experience that have helped craft this novel. It's been great.
Thanks, Andrew. I've enjoyed it. It's shaken me up a little bit thinking about all of that. So thanks for some great questions.
From 2SER comes the brand new third series of All Things Equal. Digital Divides investigates the impact the tech revolution is having on our human rights.
We are living digital lives, yeah, great, but we're also still humans.
There are amazing innovations and also terrifying consequences.
I think access to technology is extremely important.
Genetic engineering, surveillance nations, conscious AI.
When is AI going to be all around us? It's kind of all around us now.
This is one of those science technology that you cannot stop.
Hear all about it on Digital Divides. Episodes out now. Listen on your favourite podcast app.
You are on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It's books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'm joined in the studio by Karina Kilmore. Karina is a journalist with more than 30 years' experience writing for publications in Australia, the US, UK and New Zealand. And Karina has just released her debut novel. Where the Truth Lies was shortlisted in the prestigious Victorian Premier's Literary Award for an unpublished manuscript. She's joining me today to discuss Where the Truth Lies. Karina, welcome. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Andrew.
Now, Chrissy O'Brien has come to Melbourne to heal, to escape, perhaps to forget. She's landed a job at the Argus in a time of layoffs and is no one's best friend for the fact. When a Puff Piece profile interview turns dark and a young woman dies, Chrissy decides to investigate whether her bosses give her the go-ahead or not. You've crafted a tense thriller here that moves between Melbourne's docks and the Argus newsroom. And as we move deeper into the story that Chrissy is trying to uncover, I just couldn't escape the realisation that so much of the great drama hinges on what amounts to industrial relations and workplace safety. These are topics that politicians regularly fail to sell us on, but here you've created this gripping story. Why is it, for you, so important that we keep an eye on the real people amidst all of the politicking?
I grew up in a big political family in New Zealand, and as part of that I had a front row seat to all the big industrial relations disputes. Also, as a finance journalist, a business journalist, I also get to see that side of the big tribal union corporate divide from my own upbringing, so from the blue-collar side, and also as a finance journalist from the white-collar side. And so I wanted to bring this dispute into just normal storytelling. I didn't want it to be only part of a news story or only part of a television broadcast. I want unions and business and the politics that goes with that to be part of our normal everyday storytelling. So I thought I'd base a story around that crime, you know, and as a business journalist for 30 years, I've been a multiple crime writer. I've written multiple crime stories, you know, business stories. We just need to look at the banks and all the crimes that, that have happened in the last few years. And unions too, you know, union thuggery, you know, unions, you know, calling the shots, blackmailing companies. You know, there's crimes on both sides. And I wanted to bring those two big, tough issues together and have one woman, you know, an outsider from both worlds, come in and investigate both sides.
Yeah, you create this really stark juxtaposition, I notice, as Chrissy's moving through her investigation. On one page, we may see her going through pages of bland spreadsheets, and then on the next, she is talking to an informant who is fraught and panicked, not just at the person that they've lost, but fears for their own safety. And really, they're talking about the same thing. It really brought home that these spreadsheets, these facts and figures that are dealt with in offices are people's lives, and the way they move through those lives can be so depersonalised.
Yeah, as a business journalist, I automatically go to data and I analyse numbers and figures. And I wanted to show Chrissy in her world looking at these deaths and these accidents and these terrible long-term effects on these workers, looking at them from a top-down point of view, from a clinical, you know, black-and-white type on a piece of paper when she's reading about somebody losing a limb or someone dying in an accident. I wanted to both bring that home as a human story but also as a distant business story as well.
Yeah. So Chrissy has come to Melbourne from New Zealand and she's landed in an environment that isn't quite welcoming to her because she's been hired at a time of layoffs. Now, to tell the story, you've revived the masthead of the Argus. It's a newspaper that closed in Melbourne in 1957. So as a population, we're moving increasingly into getting our news from digital platforms where we're not thinking about these mastheads being, you know, printing presses and buildings that people actually work in. I wondered if this resurrection was more than just a sentimental plot device. Is diversity in media and that shrinking pool of mastheads an issue?
Yeah, I wanted to show that this is a world where if the Argus, which was one of Australia's, possibly if it was still going, Australia's oldest newspaper, if the Argus hadn't closed down, what the landscape would have been in Australia. You know, it would have this great, highly recognised newspaper, but also at the end of its physical life, at the end of its life, of its tradition is going, now it's turning to all the platforms that it needs to cover off. And in Melbourne, the Argus building still exists. It's on the corner. It's just as it's described in the book. It's a beautiful old building. And I just wanted to repopulate that building as well. I wanted to put people back in there and get them working on the newspaper that had been part of Australia's history.
Let's think about those people, because you have, I mean, obviously by necessity when you create a novel, you have to create the characters that fill it. But those hypothetical people are also the jobs that are being lost in newsrooms. And you discuss this. You show us a newsroom as that place of job cuts, of insecurity, too much work, not enough hands. Photographers are being replaced by citizen snappers and journos have to cover stories that might bring in advertising revenue rather than cover an issue that is perhaps more important. Chrissy is forced to start investigating the wharves and the story that she wants to follow on the sly because it doesn't quite have the profile to raise circulation, at least in terms of the powers that be. I wondered how these pressures actually impact, in your experience, which news gets coverage, and does it impact how that news is told to the public?
I think it does. Every day there's too much news. You know, every day there are too many topics, too many stories, too many events to cover, especially when you're getting reducing your journalist staff. So you have to automatically prioritise. And that's always been a newspaper owner's privilege to prioritise the type of news that they want in their newspaper or on their broadcast or their radio station. And so every day, every morning, there's a huge, great big news list printed out and everyone will go through it one by one and decide what's a priority. And I don't know how... As an individual, I would struggle to make those decisions. It's a really hard job. And I feel for the news editors who have to cut out some stories, you know, for the sake of others.
So News, the Fourth Estate, it has such an important role in holding power to account. It, in a very big way, supports but also, you know, challenges what happens in democracy, where we have a small number of people controlling our lives. But it seems like, as what you're saying there is, it also replicates that you have one or two people making decisions about what gets into the paper. That's a huge responsibility. Do you feel like it's something that is always done well?
I think it's always done with good intention. Mm-hmm. I'm not a cynic. Even having worked in the media for 30 years and seeing a lot of change, I still think everyone still has a really good intention to get the information out. I think the problem is that now you just have one journalist writing one story for multiple platforms. So you're only having one voice. That's the problem. You know, it's a resources issue. We don't have three or four business journalists, for example, writing the same business story. We have one journalist writing that story and sharing that across all the platforms.
Is a consequence of that also what you depict in Where the Truth Lies, where you have a story and at the very beginning, Chrissy knows something's up and she wants to pursue that story. And it's really not until the story builds, and in this case, the story building is people dying before coverage happens. That seems like a horrible consequence, and Chrissy feels the full impact of this.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens, unfortunately. We've got several cases just recently of domestic violence. Domestic violence is not new. Mm. Domestic violence has been killing women and children for decades. Because we've had a high-profile death recently, it's suddenly become news again. Mm-hmm. And that's a sadness within our society, that we wait for those big events before our news editors and news owners decide to make that a big issue again.
I am speaking with Karina Kilmore, and we're discussing Where the Truth Lies. It is an absolutely fascinating look at that role of the media and one individual reporter's quest to uncover a really shocking truth. Karina, thank you so much for this opportunity to, I guess, call on your experience to help us understand this amazing book that you've given us.
Thank you, Andrew.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It is books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you so much for bearing with me. I've been recording off-site. Social isolation has changed so much of our lives right now. And I'm so glad that I can still actually come and talk to you all about books. So thank you for joining me. Thank you also to Terence J. Quinn. He spoke to me today about his book Deadline. That was a fantastic conversation that we had before a lot of this shut down. So we got some really great audio there from Terence. And if you want to hear more from Terence, his conversation, it will be going up on the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. There is probably close to 100 episodes on the podcast for you to catch up. So these are books going back for the last couple of years, starting with absolutely fantastic titles like The Book of Dirt from Bram Presser, Behrouz Bouchani's No Friend But the Mountains, Michael Muhammad Ahmed's The Lebs, the Australian Classics Book Club, so many fantastic things, Heather Rose's Bruni. I love all of these books. I'm so happy that they're there for you to experience. I want to also thank Karina Kilmore. Karina came into the studio and we had a chance. We came into the studio back when we could all meet face to face. We got to discuss her book, Where the Truth Lies. And that full conversation will also be going up on the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Look, I have to say goodbye. It's almost time to say goodbye. I will keep coming back with more books, writing and literary culture, but I want to hear about what you're doing with books in social isolation. Have you started a digital book club? Are you writing your own book? Are you finding new things in the books that you love? Share all of those things with me. You can drop me an email. It's finaldraft@2ser.com. You can tweet me. You can Facebook me. You can Insta me at finaldraft2ser. I would love to hear how you are using books to help you cope, to help you understand, to entertain you through your social isolation. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm actually not able to do as much reading as I would like, but I'm going to keep reading for you. I've got some great stuff coming up. No matter what it takes to record it, I will bring it to you, including a new one from Tara Moss and some great Australian writers. And we've got things like the Stella Prize is going to be announcing its winner. But I have to go. It has been so great to join you. Till I see you, hear from you next week, happy reading. Bye now.